Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tearing into a legal declaration that's, honestly, it's pretty aggressive. It makes you really look hard at, well, the foundations of American government.
Yeah.
It's titled, Replaced by Fiat, When Courts Expel Reason, the Constitution, and True Law.
That title definitely doesn't pull any punches, does it? It tells you right away this isn't just about, you know, maybe tweaking the system.
Yeah.
The authors are alleging a kind of judicial revolution, almost, their core claim, that the modern judiciary in America hasn't just sort of misinterpreted the law.
Right.
They argue there's been a systematic, a deliberate takeover of constitutional authority. And this has led to what they call a crisis, a complete subversion of the republic itself.
The whole premise is incredibly stark. It's saying we basically flipped the entire American legal structure on its head.
Fundamentally inverted it, yeah.
We started out, constitutionally speaking, as a government of laws,
yeah.
Right? Meant to be run by fixed principles, common law, the Constitution. But the authors say we've slid into a government of men, where judges rule by decree, discretionary equity, basically replacing the people's judgment.
And it's not just like a philosophical debate they're having. What's really striking is the scope here. They're saying the entire foundation is flipped. So to really get the weight of that charge, this claim of usurpation, we first need to understand the legal hierarchy they insist is the only lawful structure the founders authorized.
Okay, so before we dive into how they claim it was destroyed, we need the blueprint. What exactly is this immutable hierarchy of law they keep referencing?
Right, so the source lays out four distinct tiers of authority. Starting at the very top, the absolute peak, is the ultimate source. The laws of nature and nature's God.
Okay.
They lean really heavily on Blackstone for this. They quote him saying, "No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this." So this divine or natural law principle, it's above everything humans create.
Got it. So human laws only count if they align with this higher natural law. What's the next level down then?
Tier two is what they call a fundamental maxims. Think of these as the timeless principles of justice. The ancient established rules we know as common law or the law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
The authors really stress that due process, and they cite the legal philosopher Thomas Cooley here. Due process has to be rooted in these maxims.
Okay, but this is where it feels different from how maybe most of us think about government power. We usually think written documents, like the Constitution, are number one. So why do they put constitutions on the third tier?
That's a key point they make. They argue constitutions aren't the ultimate law. They're just the written instructions, the explicit delegations of limited authority that the people, the sovereign people, grant to their government agents.
Like tools for delegation, not the source of power itself.
Exactly. And then way down at the bottom, tier four, you've got enactments, legislative statutes. The document calls these lex inferior, which just means the inferior law.
Inferior law.
Right. And they're only valid if they strictly follow the three tiers above them, natural law, the maxims, and the Constitution.
Okay, that framework makes the judge's role seem incredibly limited, doesn't it? If that hierarchy is fixed, the judge can only say what the law is.
Precisely.
But the authors claim modern courts have gone way beyond that. So what's the specific way they say this usurpation happens?
Well, the judicial role, as they define it, and they cite big cases like Marbury v. Madison, is super narrow. Just declare the law as it exists, never create it, never modify it, never rewrite it.
Right.
The source argues modern courts commit usurpation when they take judicial discretion, which often comes dressed up as, you know, discretionary equity or these chancery court powers, and they lift it above the Constitution, above the maxims, above the common law.
So they're swapping out the fixed law for their own judgment.
That's the allegation, substituting their policy ideas for the law the people actually establish.
Okay, let's really get granular on this common law versus equity thing. Because, like you said, this seems to be the absolute core of their whole argument. For someone listening, what's the simple difference and why is swapping them seen as, well, subversive?
Okay, think of it like this. Common law is the house's blueprint. It's the fixed, predictable rules based on conscience, history, natural justice, and its essential tool, the jury trial, the people's judgment.
Mm.
The source even cites old cases calling the jury the supreme tribunal. Equity, on the other hand, historically, was like the emergency valve.
Oh.
A discretionary exception, only used when the fixed common law rules would lead to a result that was just absurd or really unfair.
So common law is the rule, equity is the exception.
Exactly. Blackstone was crystal clear, equity must follow the law. But the authors argue that today, courts have systematically put the exception before the rule.
Yeah.
They claim modern judges use these procedural tricks, things rooted in equity, like summary judgment, dismissals, these broad equitable injunctions, specifically to bypass juries and ignore the fixed law.
And that's the big inversion moment they're talking about.
That's it. They're claiming judicial discretion, what they call arbitrary fiat, has elbowed out the judgment of the people. And this creates what the Declaration really powerfully calls a bastardized chancery.
Wow. Okay, so if that's the operational flip, where do the authors claim the hammer really hits the Constitution itself? Where are the direct violations?
Well, the most immediate target, the one they really hammer, is the right to a common law jury. They focus hard on the Seventh Amendment. You know, the one guaranteeing a civil jury trial if the dispute's worth more than $20.
Right, and this is where the Declaration brings in some pretty shocking numbers, isn't it?
Yeah.
The authors state that in 2023, 98% of federal civil cases valued under $25,000 were resolved without juries, just gone through summary judgment or dismissal.
And that 98% figure, for them, that's the smoking gun. It's numerical proof, they say, of a systemic breakdown.
How so?
Well, if the jury is supposed to be the supreme decider, and judges are using procedural rules to take cases away from the jury 98% of the time, the authors argue that judicial discretion has just completely replaced the people's judgment. It basically nullifies the amendment in practice.
Right.
They argue you can't just wave away a constitutional right by creating court rules that make it practically impossible to use.
It does make you ask if the right technically exists, but you almost never get to use it.
Yeah.
Is it really a right anymore?
Mm-hmm.
What about on the criminal side? The Sixth Amendment guarantees a speedy public trial with an impartial jury. But again, the source alleges systemic subversion here, too.
Yeah, here they zero in on plea bargaining. They point out that something like 95% of criminal cases are resolved without any trial at all.
95%.
And the Declaration doesn't frame this as, you know, efficient justice. They call these coerced agreements.
Coerced to how?
Extracted because the accused is facing the threat of a much harsher sentence if they actually dare to demand their constitutional right to a trial. The argument is, if exercising your right comes with a potentially ruinous penalty, it stops being a right and becomes a dangerous gamble.
And for the tiny fraction of cases that do make it to a jury, the authors claim judges are even undermining that process.
They do. They argue judges actively undermine the jury's independence.
Yeah.
By telling them not to judge the law itself, just the facts.
But isn't that standard now?
It might be standard now, but they argue it's historically wrong. They cite precedent going way back in English in early American law cases like Bushell's case, Georgia v. Brailsford, which, they say, established that juries historically judged both the law and the facts.
Okay.
So according to this document, when a judge tells a jury they can't nullify a law they find unjust, unconstitutional, that judge is basically inverting the whole check and balance idea. They're taking power away from the people's tribunal.
This whole issue of lawfulness, it brings us neatly to the Fourth Amendment, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Warrants needing particularity.
Exactly.
The source mentions the claim that, what, nearly 80% of searches happen without warrants now under these expanding exceptions. But the core point here seems to be about certainty in the law itself.
That's absolutely crucial to their argument. They link the Fourth Amendment's demand for specifics in warrants to a much bigger principle.
Mm-hmm.
Legal certainty. If a law is vague, fuzzy,
mm-hmm.
it gives officials, judges, police, prosecutors, basically unlimited discretion. They quote John Locke, "Law without certainty is tyranny."
So a vague charge in itself is an act of usurpation, according to this view.
Precisely. They argue that these broad catch-all charges, things like disorderly conduct or failure to comply, are void from the start, ab initio. Why? Because they lack clear, definite standards.
Right.
When a law basically says do whatever you think is best, the source claims it stops being a law and becomes a tool for arbitrary power, violating that core constitutional need for certainty.
We've talked about deprivation of liberty, search, and seizure. This leads right into deprivation of property, which is supposed to be protected by the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause.
Right. And the Declaration ties the Fifth Amendment, the guarantee that nobody can be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. They tie that directly back to the common law jury trial.
How so?
Citing centuries of legal tradition, going back to Magna Carta, they argued that due process of law, or law of the land, historically meant the lawful judgment of your peers, the jury.
Okay.
Therefore, according to these authors, any procedure that systematically bypasses a jury isn't due process at all. By definition, it's deprivation.
But they take this even further, right? They make a really specific kind of provocative claim about the cost of getting into court, linking modern fees to old feudal fines.
Yeah, this is one of the most specific historical points they make. They look at everyday court costs, like the pretty substantial $400 federal civil filing fee, and they slap a label on it. Unlawful amercement.
Amercement? What's that?
It was basically a discretionary fine imposed by a feudal lord back in the day.
Okay, but why is a standard court filing fee seen as some kind of illegal feudal fine?
Because, they argue, the rule of law demands justice be accessible, freely available. They point straight to Magna Carta, Chapter 20, and also the Massachusetts Constitution, Article 7, which explicitly say you shouldn't have to purchase justice.
Oh, I see.
So the authors claim that charging fees just to access the court system violates this ancient fundamental right. It turns justice into a product you have to buy. And the government, in taking that fee just for access, is essentially seizing property without a lawful warrant just to get to the remedy you're already guaranteed.
Okay, so given how severe all these claims are, I mean, alleging systematic violations of multiple amendments, rejecting the Constitution's own hierarchy, replacing the law with judicial fiat, maybe not surprising, the authors really escalate their language. They even propose a pretty radical remedy, using the word treason.
They absolutely do. They argue that judicial misconduct on this scale, specifically denying fundamental rights like the jury trial, shouldn't just be seen as errors or bad judgment. It needs to be reclassified as treason against the sovereign people.
Treason? That's a heavy word.
It is. And they try to ground it historically, citing an early American legal commentator, St. George Tucker. He apparently defined treason partly as the abuse of delegated authority to the destruction of the government itself. The authors argue this systematic dismantling of rights fits that very definition.
And this reclassification underpins their proposed solution, this thing called Operation Firewall. Can you break down how that's supposed to work? It sounds complex.
It is complex, but the idea is it's a legal reclizzing of power based on the people's ultimate sovereignty. It kicks off with what they call the affidavit process.
Okay.
Basically, citizens would document specific constitutional violations they've suffered, say, being denied the Seventh Amendment jury trial in detailed sworn affidavits.
And these affidavits are meant to meet the Constitution's very high bar for proving treason, the two-witness rule.
That's the crucial legal argument they're making, yes.
Yeah.
Article 3, Section 3 requires testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act for a treason conviction.
Right.
The authors contend that multiple sworn affidavits all documenting the same overt systemic violation, like a pattern of denying civil juries in a particular court, satisfies that two-witness requirement by documenting the act itself.
Okay, so you have these affidavits. What happens next?
They would then go to a people's grand jury.
Wait, a people's grand jury? Who runs that? How is it different from a regular grand jury?
Good question. They envision these being convened independently by a totally new, separate body they call the Government Accountability Commission, or GAC.
Okay.
The key difference is this people's grand jury would operate, they claim, in the people's original jurisdiction, completely outside the existing Article 3 court structure, which they see as compromised. And its job would be to review the affidavits and issue indictments against judges or other officials.
So an indictment from this independent body, then what? Enforcement.
Exactly. The final step is enforcement. These indictments would be executed by another proposed body, the Constitutional Enforcement Bureau, or CEB.
And who's in the CEB?
They describe it as being made up of oath-bound officers, sheriffs, marshals, people already sworn to uphold the Constitution, specifically tasked with compelling accountability and restoring what they see as the lawful constitutional order.
Now, the Declaration must anticipate the pushback, right? The standard legal shields courts have, like judicial immunity or relying on precedent, stare decisis. Mm. How do the authors deal with those?
They argue those defenses just crumble when you measure them against that immutable hierarchy of law they laid out earlier.
Okay.
So take judicial immunity. They cite existing precedent that says immunity disappears in the clear absence of all jurisdictions. Meaning, if a judge acts completely outside their delegated authority, like, say, deliberately denying a clear constitutional right like a jury trial, they argue the judge isn't acting as a judge anymore in that moment. They become, quote, a private trespasser, stripped of all official protection.
Makes sense within their framework. What about the whole idea of precedent? Stare decisis.
Mm.
You know, the idea that courts should follow past decisions. That seems like a huge hurdle.
They dismiss it pretty much outright. The source states very bluntly, precedent is not law.
Wow.
They argue courts are bound only to the Constitution and that higher law structure. They are not bound, they insist, by the errors of their predecessors.
So past mistakes don't justify future ones.
Basically. They stress that if the Constitution needs changing, that's the people's job through the Article V amendment process, not the job of judges inventing new rules from the bench. The authors essentially conclude the judiciary has no lawful refuge for its usurpations once those actions step outside the bounds of delegated power.
So what does this all mean? Taking a step back, the core conflict the authors are painting here is that the very bedrock of the American legal system, the idea of people being supreme, having fixed laws, the common law jury, they say it's been completely flipped. We've replaced a genuine republic with, well, their term is rule by robes.
That's the stark picture they leave you with, yeah. And I think the real takeaway here, the thing to focus on, is the synthesis they're attempting. They're trying to connect these really deep historical legal ideas from Blackstone, from Magna Carta, directly to these very specific modern procedural statistics, like that 98% summary judgment rate or the 95% plea bargain rate.
Right.
For the authors, those numbers aren't just interesting data points about efficiency. They are quantitative proof of a systemic constitutional collapse.
And that brings us right back to the ultimate political question this document forces onto the table.
Mm.
They spend a lot of time on Article 4, Section 4, the Guarantee Clause, the part that says the federal government has to guarantee every state a republican form of government. So if a republic is traditionally defined as a government of laws and not of men, and if the courts, according to this very detailed analysis, are systematically undermining the fixed structure of law by sidelining juries, elevating their own discretion,
then the question they force every citizen to confront is this. If the only real tether holding the government to its constitutional promises is the oath of office, and if that oath, as they allege, is being systematically broken, how do the sovereign people actually reclaim the authority they delegated, short of, well, violence?
It's a heavy question.
It really is. The mere existence of this kind of argument laid out like this, it forces us all to think hard about where the line is. Where does legitimate judicial interpretation end, and where does outright constitutional amendment by judges begin? And ultimately, what is the real measure of constitutional fidelity in a system that fundamentally relies on people keeping their sworn word?